everyone. I guess I'm being heard loud and clear. I'm not hearing any complaints. Nobody's seeing my lips move. Welcome to Satsang with G. I'm just delighted to be here as always. As some of you might have heard Don saying when he and I were talking, before the show started. This is the last show I'm going to be doing on BBS Radio, at least for a while. Just had to rearrange things to focus the attention on the areas that I'm going to get the most marketing value on. That's really the decision. Because I love those guys. I love the show. I love doing radio. I will be continuing to do Facebook Live and YouTube Live for the foreseeable future. It just won't be going out on the radio network. So, welcome everyone. Welcome, welcome, welcome. Thank you for being here. Oh boy, we have a question already coming up on the chat on YouTube. Come on, folks on Facebook. Time for you to catch up. I need some few comments in there. I titled this show "The End of Time." A very lofty title, to be sure. But we have, we experience in our lives, what we experience in our lives is a direct result of what we hold to be true about ourselves, about the world around us, about our lives, about others. We experience our perception of things. In fact, that's all we experience, is our perception of things. We don't experience things as they are. We experience what we believe them to be. It's a very powerful thing to grasp. And if we were to grasp this, especially as a whole, as a world, all the arguments and fights and everything would just disappear overnight, because they are all based on the assumption that my view is right and your view is wrong. And I'm going to assert my view and dominate you or even kill you off if need be. And it's all an attachment to a perception. Time is one of those perceptions. It is a word we have used to describe experience. No, human beings are natural and prolific describers of experience. Ever since we got the ability to do that, we've been, writing on the walls, and we created language, which came later. We created music and drumming and singing and dancing, all and story upon story about the origin of things, because there's a part of us that just needs to have things explained. And what we're trying to explain is the experience we're all having. We're trying to make sense of the world around us. And of course, this becomes increasingly difficult when you realize that we don't really even see the whole world around us. We see snippets, we see parts, what we see in terms of our eyes, the visible light, is an extremely small portion of what light is. What we hear with our ears is nothing compared to what a dog hears, or smell with our nose. They have 20,000 times the number of smell receptors in their nose that we do. Maybe that's a good thing. But I think you kind of get the point that we're trying to explain in a comprehensive and meaningful and substantive and satisfying way something that is completely beyond the range of our senses to even perceive, let alone recognize and identify. Time is one of those things. Time is often described as a river, right? We see that we talk about the river of time. And everything is flowing through this river of time. And all events are being carried. I'm being carried through time. as if time was this continuous thing, never started and never stopped. And stuff kind of like a river, it just keeps going. And we, you know, drop stuff in there. We go swimming in it. We get out. We sail down it. We throw things in it. We try to dam it and reroute it other places. It's a good metaphor, but is it really true? One of the most amazing powers that the human being has is the power of abstraction. and the power of abstraction, excuse me, the power of abstraction is our ability to take very complex things and reduce them down to a simple idea that we can do something with. I mean, it's very, very powerful, right? I mean, take the example of the body. I say the body. You know what I'm talking about. And yet, the body actually is 100 trillion cells, thousands, tens of thousands of processes, thousands and thousands of things going on, chemicals. I mean, the actual body itself is so complex, there's simply no way every time you wanted to talk about the body, you could describe it. So instead, we use this word, and everybody knows what we're talking about. We have the same thing with car, right? You know, say car, you know what I'm talking about. I don't have to describe every car in existence, or dog, or something. You know what it is. This is abstraction. It's really powerful. All language is an abstraction. It's a symbolic representation of something else. But here's the interesting thing about it, what the mind does. The moment the mind creates an abstraction, it assigns to that thought the status of having an actual existence outside of it being merely a representation of something else. And that's when the story starts. So when we use the word body, there's what it's actually referring to, and then there is all the ideas and thoughts and concepts and images and projections and assumptions I have about it that are all attached to that single word. And it gets even worse because you get enough of those abstractions together and they become too complex, and then we make another one. I mean, you call it a community. That's an abstraction. When communities do this, or a group, or a nation, right? These are all abstractions built, you know, the nation built out of states, built out of communities, built out of families, built out of individuals, right? And we're still talking about layers of abstraction sitting on top of this simple idea to represent something very complex, namely the body. And at every single one of those levels, as we do that, an entire narrative gets created that describes it as if it existed independently of everything else underneath it. Now, what is time? Time's an abstraction. We say the word, can anybody point to time? Can anybody show me a picture of time? We have clocks to measure time. And what are they measuring? I mean, they measured we took a unit and we could all agree on this. We divided it up. We made instruments in order to represent it. Now we say, oh yeah, I'm on time or I'm late. Let's go right down to the actual experience of it. What happens at the actual experience of it is that we notice things change. Situation change, circumstances change, people change, sometimes slowly, sometimes quickly. But everything around us is actually constantly changing. Bzz, all the little molecules, all the atoms, whatever the atoms are made of, whatever those are made of, and those are made, going all the way down to the bottom, which nobody's gotten to yet. They're all levels at which different things apply, different rules apply. And it's really fascinating because you know, there was a time when Newton, the great physicist Newton, his laws of physics that he laid down were the Bible. That was it. That was the only way things worked. And it was assumed that that worked that way everywhere in the universe. Well, along comes Einstein and says, well, that's not actually true. It's relative, actually. And there's places they don't work. It's different. The laws of governing gravity of large bodies is completely different. And as a matter of fact, the gravity, when you get down to the microscopic level, the levels of atoms, there is no gravity. It has no effect whatsoever. Now that's interesting, isn't it? And quantum and all the subatomic mathematics has a completely different set of rules. So there's the rules of the really big and there's the rules of the really little. But the thing is that it doesn't throw Newton out. We all still use all of his laws. We fly airplanes. We build electronics. All of these things are the laws that work very well in our little bubble here. But we've begun to realize that it's a bubble. And so we've created this idea of time to try to explain experience, just like our most primitive ancestors did as they were drawing pictures of the hunt on the wall. What we experience is change. And we name that change time. And time becomes a measurement of it. I can measure how fast this change or how slow. If we all agree on a certain thing, okay, we're going to put the stake here. We can all agree on it. So we can talk now about how long something takes or how short something takes. But of course, that stick could be picked up and moved anywhere. There's nothing saying it has to be there. So time as a thing doesn't exist. And this is where it gets really amazing, because the moment we've got time now, it has become an abstraction removed from what it's actually just a word to explain change. We start thinking, oh, time is terrible. Time's slow. I'm running out of time. Oh, I wish I had enough time. There's not enough hours in the day. Our stories are built on something that doesn't have a real existence. Time doesn't exist. Only the experience of change exists. I'll push it one step further for you. Can that which witnesses change itself be changing? Is there an ultimate, timeless, motionless standpoint from which anything and everything is observed? It's a question to just chew on. I say yes. Not only do I say yes, but I say, you're it, and that is the place you've been looking from the whole time. But you bought the idea that you are a bunch of things changing, moving through time. This time that doesn't actually exist. Can anybody here not be in the now? Can anybody here step out, leave the now, say, okay, that's it, I'm checking out. I'm not going to be here now. Can anybody do that? Of course, the answer is no, you can't. Nobody can get out of now. It's all we actually know. It's all we ever actually experience. You can't go back and visit the past. Validate that terrible thing your brother did to you when you were six. You can't go into the future. You simply cannot do it. And yet, at the same time, even though the now is the only thing we've ever experienced, we throw all of our attention in the past and in the future. You've never, ever experienced the past or the future. You have only experienced now. Now, in the amount of time that I've been sitting here talking to you, and you've been listening, How many nows have passed? If you want to just, you know, narrow it down to just, you know, the last couple of, you know, 10 seconds. How many nows in a second? Look at it closely. I mean, really, really look. We assume that we're this object flowing through time. And yet when you look for time, you can't find it. We assume the power of the past, but when you look for the past, you can't find it. We live in fear of the future. And then when you look for the future, you can't find it. In fear of time, and you look for time, you can't find it. And yet that which you can find somehow gets diminished, made small. It's only like this moment that I happen to be experiencing time. And I see my life as a flow of all of these events. How many times did you count? How many nows did you count? The only thing anyone ever has ever experienced is one infinite, eternal, unending, timeless now. That's it. That's the only thing anyone really experiences. And yet our beliefs are 99% against that. They push everything away from that. There's this other times and other circumstances and all these other things which are nothing but memory, which gives rise to the illusion of time. You've never been anywhere but now. Now, let that really sink in for a minute. There's no past. There is no future. You are forever ensconced in the now, watching as things come and go in and out of the now. You don't even know if the thing you're experiencing right now even existed before or if it has any existence afterwards, because it's gone. Does it live somewhere other than your imagination? This has very practical applications, by the way. I'm not just going to sit here and talk to you philosophically about it. Very practical applications. Because how much stuff going on in your life? Because I started this whole thing talking about perception, right? How we perceive the world is what we experience in the world. How much of what you are experiencing right now do you believe is the result of what happened in the past? I mean, the entire psychology and self-help and everything is based on it. And I actually do teach that in inner reconciliation as part of the process, but it's not the ultimate goal. Eventually I get people to see that the only thing producing your life now is your belief now. That the thing that happened in the past isn't what's causing the present. It is your belief in the thing in the past that is causing the present. And without that belief, no event in the past has any power whatsoever, has no influence, has no authority, has no place, nothing. It is all being given to it right here, right now, by you and your belief in it, your belief in the past. Same thing about anticipation of the future, which is rarely what we expect, but we live in a immediate sense of worry or anxiety or concern or doubt or even fear of the future, which also doesn't exist. Our thoughts about the future, what might happen in the future, they create the feeling in the moment. And if those feelings are strong enough, your nervous system will begin to filter things out and actually look for evidence of it. Literally believe it into existence as a present experience. And even if you don't, you're still going to feel like it. You're still going to be anticipating. You're still going to be waiting for that other shoe to drop. Even though none of it is real, all of it is being self-generated in this moment. So step back. What's actually true in this moment? Well, you are. That which is monitoring the time, that which is watching things move by, that which is aware of all of the motion, all of the activity, all of the change. Look at that and tell me if that's changing. Not an idea about that. The assumption, oh yeah, it's changing. Of course it's changing. We're always changing. I'm changing, but I'm changing slower than that, so that's why I see it go by. You know, I'm on the train and a jet plane goes by. The jet plane's going to be looking like slower than the train is, but I'm still moving. Look for that moving. Look for any evidence of that moving. Look for any evidence whatsoever that anything exists other than right now. And then look where you live. It's a powerful meditation to just focus your attention on the you that is experiencing time and not the image of yourself in time. I mean, if you look at your life, you will find that what I'm referring to, you, which has been perceiving every single thing going on in your life, hasn't changed. Circumstances have. Events have, people have, all sorts of, your body has. But something hasn't changed. And it's that something I constantly want to bring your attention back to. Because that, folks, is not an abstraction. That is not an idea. That is not a concept. That's you. All right. I got a couple questions here. This one from Sylvie Amor. I'm not sure I'm pronouncing that name. I love having people around the world. It's great. Even if you're... Anyway, if awareness is impersonal, how come personal desires can be fulfilled? Well, you're thinking that there's this person and then that there's impersonal awareness as if they're two. There's only impersonal awareness. You're calling that desire a personal desire because it relates to this particular body mind and something it needs or that, but it is the awareness. Everything is the awareness. I mean, does this desire arise somewhere outside of awareness, or does it arise to awareness? So what if the desire is related to something? It always is. Awareness has no desires, but it gives rise to all desires. One of the key things I teach in Inner Reconciliation, the kind of the bridge between real spirituality and the whole metaphysics law of attraction thing, is that desire isn't, no desire is personal. All of it's arising. You think the desire for food, the desire for all of your basic needs, desire to survive, your desire for food, your desire for sex, right? All of that. Is any of it personal? You made it up? I have a desire to have sex. Like nobody else does. It's the body's desire. It's natural. It's nature. It's not personal. It's not yours. It's not you. Now, some we could. I want to have more money in the bank. Well, if you look really closely, what you really want is a sense of safety, which isn't you. And you might think, well, I want to have this amount of money in it and how that's personal. But it's not. It's just another layer on top of the desire for safety and freedom. And in our world, our culture, money represents safety and freedom. The more money you have, the more you can do. But there, you've heard me say before, the person you think you are is an image in the mind. Right? It's an abstraction. It's not who you are. You are that awareness. So every desire that arises is coming from there. And that's how they can be fulfilled. They're not personal. No desire is personal. Isn't that a mind blower? Every desire we have is completely and totally natural to all human beings. We all have them. It may vary, you know. I want ice cream. I want strawberry ice cream. I want chocolate. I want Rocky Road. But look at it. It's all the same. You'll find that the more you realize that what's going on within you isn't personal, you find your troubles begin to get very, very small. It's just the natural functioning of life. And you are the awareness of life. And life springs from this function, this awareness. So, Sylvie, you can comment some more if that helps. It's a big thing, and I could talk about that all day. actually, because it isn't a disowning. Notice I'm not a spiritual teacher. It says you shouldn't have any desires. You know, detach from all your desires. Feel no desire. You must transcend all desires. It's nonsense. It's like saying I have to transcend breathing. No, they're part of life. They just are not. When they become personal, now you begin to start thinking things. They become an abstraction now, right? Now it's this thing, this desire is the reason. I got to get this desire. And if I don't get this desire, then the story goes on. And we have just created a truck full of suffering. But if you see every desire that's arising as an energy in and of itself, it has its own life. It has its own lifespan. It has its own purpose. It has its own means for fulfillment. And if the causes and conditions and the circumstances are right, it will be fulfilled. It'll grow into fulfillment. If not, it won't. You know, just like, you know, the vast majority of seeds that are put out by plants never germinate and live. Every one of those is a potential life, a potential form that could create hundreds of millions of replicas of itself going forward into time. Human beings, it appears, the human body evolved out of a very small group of people. We all have one common ancestor, if you can believe that. And how many strains didn't make it? How many just kind of fell off to the side? Just because a seed is produced, and just consider your desire a seed, doesn't mean it's going to take root and grow. If you attach no story whatsoever to desire and recognize it just as a natural arising within the heart, within the system, within what it means to be human, what it means to be a fully conscious, aware being, and that it has its life to live, its fulfillment, you will experience what they refer to as the spiritual detachment. Not by a denial or getting rid of it, by recognizing that it's got its life. How many of the desires that have come up from you have been fulfilled? And they haven't devastated you, right? You know, some get fulfilled and it's wonderful, some don't. This, to take that into your heart is to be free from the person. And that means to be free, period. And you can just really love life, love the natural flow of life that is in you and around you and, in fact, is made of you. All righty, here's one from Tom. Taking action caused by a thought that arose from a strong conditioning strengthens the conditioning. But what if we simply observe that thought, watch it pass, and then decide to take that action? We'll follow up here. Of course, the mind and its conditioning will never leave us alone, but it's still nice to know a way to not build our conditionings unnecessarily by our actions. All right. Conditioning produces nothing, okay? Conditioning is a reaction to things. This is really important to get. Now, if you're taking action on something that arises within you, on behalf of your conditioning, that is the sense of a separate self, the person, and all of that, it's not going to work. Does it strengthen the conditioning? I wouldn't go so far as to say it's strengthening it. It certainly doesn't dismantle it, right? If you realize that every true desire arises from this place, and every true desire is pure and innocent, but it runs into the conditioning within our energy system, which is a reaction to it. You know, like a strong natural desire to be creative. You grew up in an environment that wasn't at all creative and didn't like the idea of it. Wanted, you know, you're going to be a lawyer or a doctor or an engineer or something. I don't want any of these dancer things in our house, right? if you can grasp that, then you can see that the conditioning is reacting to that. That the impulse towards it is very natural, but there's a layer of conditioning now that has been laid on top of it, right? Because it wasn't safe for that energy to be expressed within the environment. That gets turns into the conditioning that keeps it from emerging. And that conditioning doesn't know that the environment has changed. It assumes the environment is the same, and it's got to keep that state going. So your conditioning isn't producing a thought, okay? Our natural inclination towards freedom and safety and love and connection, that is producing the thoughts, and it's running into the conditioning. Now, when something comes up, a strong desire like that, it can trigger a lot of conditioning. But oftentimes we think of somehow that this is a bad desire, this is a good desire. The only thing it takes a desire and makes it bad is that it gets kind of distorted, you know? If some desire comes up that is something you want, but the conditioning won't allow it, and you play the little game with yourself, and you eventually try to turn it into some kind of desire that will get approved of by the board of the conditioning, it's not really a true desire. That happens all the time. That's a false desire. It didn't start that way, but it got so morphed, so distorted, out of character in order to fit what could get by the conditioning, and that's what happens. I mean, a lot of negative behavior is because of that. It's this desire to express yourself, and it's not allowed to, so it can come out in rebellious ways, it can come out in really extreme ways, and even come out in violent ways, because there's this energy that wants to get out, and it's not allowed to. But the essence of it, the essence of every single one of those, is absolutely innocent and pure. So what happens is we master this, we don't discern what's a good desire and what's a bad desire. We begin to discern the character that's been laid upon the desire in order to get through to the place where it can have some chance of coming to fruition. Because we can't let these desires go. We can't. Your natural inclination, the reason you exist is to express yourself. That's why there is a body. That's why there's a world. That's why it's here, for that expression to take place. But this conflict between this self-expression and the safety that is very tribal and has its rules and limitations and all that kind of stuff, but its essence is nothing more than the safety mechanism trying to protect you, right, from what it regards to be as dangerous conditions. Seeing that, all desire becomes innocent. It all becomes pure. It all becomes divine. And at the same time, when it becomes that natural thing emerging, there's no attachment to it anymore. Because the space for it to live its life without any thinking it has to fulfill something or it has to do something, for all that's gone. It just arises, does its thing, and it disappears. And that is the flow of life, which is happening now. Not in the past, not in the future, but right now. Hope that got it for you, Tom. Great question. That's all, folks. It says, from my experience, when observing these types of thoughts, watching them pass, the need desire to take action vanishes as well. It might. Yeah, it might. Don't be surprised if it doesn't. Because life is about action, about taking action. We just want that action to be inspired. We want the action to match as closely the original inspiration as it possibly can. Now, it's not going to match it completely, right? I mean, I think it's really amazing that by the Fifth Symphony, Ludwig van Beethoven was totally deaf. He didn't actually hear the things that he wrote. And there are actually some bits of evidence, especially towards the end of his career, that the stuff was getting to the point where it was almost out of this world. It was like hard. hard to play and articulate and the like. It was like he was going off to a completely different space. So I forgot my whole train of thought on that. Just really remarkable that the creative energy finds the most conducive avenue it can. Now, I know somebody who's written music. Well, the way I hear it in my head is never what it sounds like when it comes out. Because in my head, it's exactly what it is, right? And I'll just be in awe of it for a bit. And then when I try to actually get it out, I'm working in this world, the world of time and space, right? Our conceptions of time and space. I'm working with the instruments that are available to us. I'm working with the things that are here. And so they're going to color it. It's like, you know, take your favorite song and sing it. Then here's somebody who's an amazing singer singing. Maybe you are an amazing singer, in which case it's great. But, you know, an opera singer will sing it, or then a country singer will sing it. The same song, sung 100 different ways, sounds different, yet it's the same song, isn't it? If it's played as an instrumental, or if it's a big band, or if it's an orchestra, or if it's a guitar, and I mean, same song, right? The essence is the same. Now, where you go with that, what you work with that, is going to involve this interaction with your conditioning. So not all conditioning is bad, is what you're saying, and I agree. And I think Tom said, sure, but your conditioning might push you towards yes. No, the conditioning, the less conditioning there is, the more you'll be moving towards wise decisions, towards the wise direction. Because the wisdom is in the thing itself, right? Wisdom is in the truth of the thing. I mean, it's wise when something is allowed to be what it is. That's about as wise as you can get. So when it is what it is, there's no internal conflict, there's nothing resisting it. And so the less conditioning is interfering with that, the better off you are. But you're absolutely right. Conditioning in and of itself isn't a problem. As a matter of fact, I'm talking right now. I'm not thinking about it. I'm not planning. I'm not going, mark your mouth. Right? It's all happening automatically. That's conditioning. You learned how to play music. You learned how to walk. You learned how to dance. You learned how to do anything that the body can do. Feed yourself, you know, bathe yourself. All of that is a result of conditioning. The very same mechanism. It's either a vehicle for freedom or it's a vehicle for bondage. And it depends on how it has been conditioned. And of course, that's what we're here to do our very, very best. Let me check Skype here. Okay. That's messages. I need to check Skype. Our job is to make that conditioning completely functional. The problem is it's dysfunctional. Now, it's dysfunctional because our world has changed, our desires have changed, and we have grown up. It was 100% functional at the time, in the moment when it got put into place. I want you to understand this. You're not broken. There's no such thing as bad conditioning. Your nervous system is absolutely brilliant and never gets it wrong. Okay? So it created, out of all of the stuff it had available to it when you were a child, and you are who you are, reacting to an environment that is what it is, you're the vulnerable one, They're the powerful ones. Your nervous system's job is to keep you safe. It is going to create a set of conditions that will keep you safe. Congratulations. It worked. You're here. You're listening to me. The only problem is that the conditions change, but the energetic assumption within the system is that they haven't changed. So it tries to reproduce it. Anything does change, it tries to bring it back into that model. It wants to hold on to what it has. It's just trying to keep you safe. You're not broken. So now, when we have a different vision of what's possible, we have different abilities, we have different powers, we're not so vulnerable anymore. We're now the ones calling the shots, at least to some degree. That very same conditioning that was protecting you is now in the way of you. And that's, of course, when we set up the argument, we do, you know, psychologically, we do all sorts of things to fix it, but it's not broken. It doesn't need to be fixed. It needs to simply be shown that it's different. It needs to be shown in ways that are loving, that are kind, that are embracing, that are able to that are wise, that are understanding. And the mechanism that created the conditioning will itself begin to migrate that conditioning to fit the new environment, because that's what it does. It doesn't stay there stuck. Oh, I'm going to leave you stuck there. It shifts because the environment's changed. Oh, it's changed. I've got to create a new set of stuff. It'll be resistant at first, because in the new environment, it doesn't know if it can keep you safe or not. But when it accepts the environment has changed and it has a certain surrounding of safety, a little envelope of safety around it, so it feels it's safe to do that, it will simply reorganize itself in this new environment. And suddenly now you'll call yourself functional. I'm functional now. All that means is that my energy system is now matching the new environment that I'm in. Until the next time you have another insight, another deepening of your vision, another thing that wants to change, or if you've exhausted all the things that can happen on this level and you want something new, it's going to happen again in the same resistance. You may even call it dysfunctional. It's not dysfunctional. It's functioning perfectly. It's doing exactly what it was designed to do. The only thing that's dysfunctional is us thinking that we know better than it does. So I want you to understand that. I really got off on the whole time thing, but that's okay, because I like to answer the questions that people are actually asking, rather than just kind of making stuff up. It brings it home, makes it earthy. Because we want freedom. And what does freedom mean? Freedom's not theoretical. It's not out there somewhere. Theoretical is freedom is a feeling within us. It's a sense of well-being that isn't attached to circumstances. It feels good even when the circumstances say it shouldn't feel good. And that's freedom. That means when your conditioning isn't reacting to a situation, but is flexible and nimble, suddenly your resourcefulness is infinite. There's nothing you can't deal with. There's nothing you can't handle. And you don't need to have visualize until your head pops. You don't need to control anything. You don't need to make things be a certain way so you can handle them. You can handle anything as it happens, because life is nothing but change, and you're the now. Okay, I got 10 more minutes. Let's see. The other son, doesn't non-duality imply that the law of attraction is meaningless, as this channel is merely a perception within my consciousness and its infinite activities? Wow, great question. And I always love to speak on different levels. I wouldn't call it meaningless until you are at a level of non-dual experience where you can see it within context. The human mind does create what it believes, and that is the essence of the law of attraction. Now, the law of attraction assumes that there's me and you, that we're separate selves, and that somehow I've got my private consciousness and my private beliefs and my private energy and vibration that is attracting things. and that there are the things to be attracted. Well, that's not absolutely true. Now, depending who I'm talking to, I might talk like it is true. So don't hopefully you don't get confused by the fact that I can mix. I jump levels all the time based on who the audience is that I'm talking to. But you've asked the right question. You've asked the pertinent question. From the point of view of pure non-duality, there's nothing to get. There's nothing to give. There's no one to get from or give to. There is only pure awareness, aware of itself. So there's nothing that needs to be attracted because there's nothing missing. Now, the thing I always like to point out that's very important, because a lot of people hear the teachings of emptiness, they hear teachings about non-duality, and they think, well, oh, there's just awareness, there's nothing, right? And that's not true. There's just awareness, there's everything. The only thing that makes it dual or non-dual is thinking that the objects of perception exist independently of the perceiver of it, and the perceiver of it is independent from others. That the perceiver is a person. What you are perceiving is yourself. And the one perceiving is the infinite awareness. There's a thought in the mind that the one perceiving is this person who's trying to become enlightened and non-dual. It's not true. It's a thought. It's an abstraction. It's a belief. It isn't true. The one who's looking out from behind your eyes right now is the infinite one of consciousness. When Papaji, the great sage Papaji, met Ramana Maharshi, the thing he always used to do to trip up the sages, the people he would meet, he was always successful at it. He'd say, well, okay, if you're this sage or this holy man, show me God. Show me God. Now, Papaji had grown up playing with God. Krishna used to appear to him. It's the whole part of the story. Very, very fascinating. Ramana says, comes back to him and says, I can't show you to God, show you God. God is what's looking out. God is who's looking out from behind those eyes. And it just knocked him on his feet. The idea that somehow I could find God somewhere, only to discover that it's been God doing the looking all the entire time. So when you go into the non-dual stuff, please don't take it like a philosophy. You have to look very, very closely at who you are. And so from that point of view, yes, the law of attraction, nothing. It's a word. It means nothing. It's an abstraction. There's only the natural phenomena of my own existence. And my own existence is the only one there is, and not just me personally. Like I said, when I started the show, I talked about, you know, count the nows. How many nows have there been since the beginning of the show? And there's only been one. Now, do you think my now and your now are different now? Are they different nows? So I seem to be in a different place with different consciousness, doing different things. Is it different? Is it different now? It's the same now. The we is appearing in the same now. The consciousness that you're experiencing right now, that's hearing my words, seeing the image of me on the screen, or maybe just hearing the words, it's experiencing the room you're sitting in, anything else you might be doing. That consciousness, do you think that's different from this one here? That there's a different consciousness here that's speaking and hearing and reading your question? The idea that you have your own consciousness is one of the abstractions, and it's based on the body, based on the idea that you are your body. You're not. You're consciousness. And there's only one of them. So thank you for that very, very probing question, the other son. It's delightful Absolutely delightful. I get the whole range. So, but please don't be appalled that a non-dual teacher, which I primarily am, is teaching about the law of attraction, and the nervous system, and energy healing, and things like that. It's all part of how we gently and naturally begin to merge back into ourselves, where consciousness, we really are, which has been so focused outward and feeling so separated from itself, which of course it can't actually be separated from itself, begins to turn around and move back towards itself. The closer back towards yourself, the real source and energy and reality of consciousness, the more non-dual it becomes. But if somebody is just out there, just awash in the muck and suffering, anything I can do to turn them around a little bit and bring them closer, I will. That's the job of the teacher. I don't get the people who are, you know, ready for that last moment to pop the bubble. They come from all different avenues, all different walks of life, all different ways of seeing things, all different levels of suffering. Remember, the Buddha set out on his journey not to get enlightenment, but to alleviate suffering. He wanted to know the cause of suffering. That's what led him to the ultimate awakening. Anattara Samyak Sambodhi, the great unparalleled enlightenment. It was the search for the end of suffering and the cause of suffering, which he found. Laid it down at first it is noble in the noble truths, but eventually even transcended those. So, I hope that answered your question. I'm not seeing any new questions here on the queue. Let me take a quick check back here at Facebook, because I'm not seeing any on Facebook. But there's only a couple people on Facebook, so no new questions there as well. So, all right. Well, we're kind of beginning to wind it down anyway. So, as always, thank you all for being here. I really do love your questions. I will be continuing to do this, even after the radio show has ended. And hopefully that's temporarily. Hopefully I'll be able to come back on to that. I'm easy to find on YouTube. I'm easy to find on Facebook. I'm always open to people's questions. And I hope you'll check out the Master Heart Institute, where we have all the courses where I teach this from all levels, all the way from the most basic all the way up to the deepest non-duality I can muster. I guess without any further ado, I will just, the music should start playing here. Yes, it does there. But I'm cute. These guys are great. Radio show. Thank you for being here. Love you all. Until next time.